Philip Morgan.
Listen, Witherell, how's it going, my man?
Oh, it's going, you know, just living like a baller out of control. No one believes that, by the way, do they? I don't think so.
Well, you got to back it up. You have to pay that off.
Well, I just ordered my latest grill from Paul Wall, but it hasn't come yet.
Your latest grill?
Grill, yes.
Okay.
Do you know what that means?
Well, I mean, I'm assuming you're not talking about barbecuing in your backyard.
No, but I like those grills much better. I think grills are kind of a dated thing now. I don't think anyone pays attention to grills. Speaking of grills, Philip, what are you promoting today?
Oh, man. Right. I have to promote something.
Well, you don't have to.
Shoot. You go first. I'll think about it while you start.
Well, today I'm promoting salesin30.com. It's a free course with 10 different videos, and I'm making those as we speak. If you're listening to this in April of 2018 or later, all the videos are there. I invite you to sign up to learn much more than you know about selling your own services within 30 days or less. That's salesin30.com. SALESIN30.com.
Well, I guess I'll continue to promote Specialization School, specializationschool.com. That is sort of where I'm pushing things with my business. It's, I think, for folks who are trying to make that decision about how to specialize or how to move out of that generalist market position. It's the best I have to offer. It's a series of workshops. I'm building it as I go. And it takes everything I've learned about this transition and bakes it into a repeatable process. So that would be specializationschool.com. And if anything there piques your interest, just drop me a line, Philip with one L, at philipmorganconsulting.com.
Does that mess people up? They don't know that your name has one L and they say they emailed you and it never arrives?
No, but it is the less common spelling. So if you grew up with a name where there's two spellings, there's plenty of people like that. Although I doubt that's you. they're probably just, everybody's asked, how do you spell that? Anyway,
yeah, well, go ahead.
You grew up with a name with like two spellings. You figure out pretty quickly which team you're in. And I'm in team less common spelling. So most people would use two L's if I didn't instruct them on how to spell it.
Right. Yeah. The only alternative spelling that I see of my name, Liston, is Listen, which is clearly listen. It's an existing word, but people miss that, I guess.
I can see that. Yeah.
Yeah. So, Philip, I have given something up, and I want to announce it here publicly.
You quit cigarettes again?
No, I have not smoked for many, many years, but I quit drinking coffee a few weeks ago and I've had nothing but tea.
Woo! It feels
a little bit weird, I have to say. Are you a coffee drinker?
I am I'm a regular caffeine drinker. So you and my friend Dave Hefner both have recently quit coffee. Dave's, I think, quit more than once, which just increases my esteem for him. How's it been? Have you quit caffeine or just quit coffee?
No. I told my wife to get the most caffeinated tea she could find. So I'm a frequent caffeine drinker, but I just quit coffee. And I don't know if this is permanent or what, but it's just hard on the system. It's very acidic. It dehydrates you.
Yeah, it has sort of a jittery high. What tea are you drinking?
I am drinking some mate and some black tea.
Okay. Like English breakfast, like that strikes me as one of the higher caffeine black teas.
Yeah. Just like the black tea off the shelf at Whole Foods.
Okay. So any improvements you're seeing or you feel different?
I'm definitely not as jittery. You're right. I mean, I would parade through the house. You know, I'm home alone with just the pets and I would like sing songs to the pets and like yell and do all kinds of things to get energy out. in between my coaching calls. And so that felt like a little bit much.
That's hilarious.
So yeah, I would say that's the biggest change, but also less stomach problems because I just found the coffee to be so hard on my system. And granted, I was drinking way too much of it.
Yeah.
But you know, I'm also a repeat quitter of lots of things in my life because I have such an addictive personality.
Yeah.
So it's hard for me to go, oh, I'll just have one cup. That is not my style.
Yeah, I do drink less. I consume caffeine less frequently throughout the day. So I used to be like a 3 or 4 hit of like a significant amounts of caffeine person.
Yeah.
Now I'm down to 2 or 1, depending on the day. That feels like progress. And I think that was really just sleeping more is what contributed to that. Just made it easier. Oh,
so you're less tired?
Yeah, I think so. I think I was just, you know, for several years, just overworking, to be frank.
Yep. Well, also too much caffeine tends to ruin your sleep, which then makes you crave more caffeine because you're so tired.
Yeah.
So yeah,
talk about a downward spiral.
Yeah, I'm big on no caffeine after 2 p.m. So I pretty much drink caffeinated drinks all morning, but then after that, I have none.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, tea is also, I mean, I know that there's a tremendous sort of depth of interesting stuff to try in the world of coffee, but tea is equally as interesting in terms of flavors and nuance. And if you're into it at all, I don't get the impression you are, but if you're at all into it for like the hardware or the geeky aspect of no. getting into a thing, okay, I didn't think so. But yeah, tea has just as much to offer there as coffee does.
I have a gigantic hot water kettle, and then I have tea bags. And my wife, because of some good friends of ours, they gave us a bunch of these loose leaf tea. There's an amazing tea shop in Portland called Townsend's. Uh-huh. And we have all this loose leaf tea in our cupboard, but I don't want to deal with the mess that it creates. Like there's so much cleanup and I just like can't be bothered with it. So I drink my tea and then I put the spent tea bags in the compost bin and I'm done with it.
That's actually even, I mean, there's sort of more crap to deal with coffee.
Yes.
Then versus tea bags. Have you been to the Dow of Tea? That's another really nice tea shop that at least last time I was there in Portland, I think was still around on Belmont.
I've not been there.
You might like it. It's pretty cool. But again, it's very loose leaf tea centric. So that may be too fussy for you.
Well, that's fine. That's fine if someone else is going to prepare it and clean it up. That's how I feel about that. I just don't want to deal with it every single morning.
Yeah.
So today, Philip, I feel like I've done a really bad job of articulating this, so I think I'm going to defer to you on the intro today.
All right. I think this has come up for both of us in various conversations we've had, and today I'm feeling extra desirous of sort of offering the disclaimer that you and I both talk to a lot of people who are seeking the help that we provide. So they come to us with like all these interesting fodder in terms of questions. And we often turn those into content for our various email list or podcasts or what have you, and try to do that with I guess the disclaimer is we really want to be sensitive to the fact that these problems are, you know, they're real, they're often painful. And so if we're like kind of joking during the answer, it's because we just like enjoy joking around, but we're also trying to provide a valuable, relevant answer to these questions.
And also I think it's worth pointing out that when we bring these topics to the podcast, it's because a lot of people are experiencing the same thing.
Yeah.
It's not happening in isolation. No one's being picked on. In fact, it's just the opposite. It's we're trying to create something that will be applicable to a large number of people because we hear these things over and over again.
Yeah.
So I think that's worth saying as well.
Yeah, I think that's what I was trying to get at is never are we like, oh gosh, how silly that you would have this problem. In fact, suffering alone is one of the worst things. Like if you hear Brene Brown talk about stuff that leads you to emotionally dark places, a lot of times it's feeling like you're alone or isolated in something. And, you know, we get to see the fact that you're not. You may not see that. If you're suffering with some sales problem or some positioning problem, you may feel very alone in that, but it's almost like 9 times out of 10, there's at least probably 100 or 1,000 other people who are dealing with that exact same thing.
Right.
So anyway, I feel like that's worth saying. I guess I'm just saying it to myself more than anything, but in case anyone listening is wondering.
Wow, we're so PC today, Philip.
I know. So here's what we want to talk about. This particular question, if it's a pattern of, I'm starting my business, there's parts of doing that that I don't like, or I don't feel good at, or I know that I suck at. And so part of my future vision for my business is not having to do those things. Maybe I'll delegate them. Maybe I'll automate them away. Maybe I'll, you know, some magic fairy will show up and just make it so I don't have to do those to run a successful business. To me, that's the core of the question. And there's several like things specifically that you might hear someone put in that bucket of, I guess I have to do it now, but I'm kind of hoping I don't have to do it now. But when I dream about the future business I'm trying to build, I have a dream of delegating that stuff or not having to do it, right? Like that's the kind of core of the dynamic we're talking about. And so the things that would fit in that bucket that people hope to rid themselves of the need to do are sales writ large, marketing writ large, or some specific aspect of those they don't like talking to prospects and not knowing if they're qualified would be another thing. I've heard people wonder if they can remove the need to do that. And I guess I'm tipping my hat by calling it the need to do that, right? I'm sort of suggesting that maybe you do need to do that. We'll get right to that. But what else do you see people want to put in that bucket list and of stuff they kind of wish they didn't have, they either dream of not having to do in the future, or they just are wondering if they can skip it altogether?
Yeah, you know, maybe it's because of where I'm focused for a lot of people and the type of help that I offer. But typically for me, it seems like lead generation and selling, and probably lead generation is the number one thing that I hear a lot of people wanting to outsource. But I think there's also, you know, I'm looking at the E-Myth. Are you familiar with that book?
Yep. There's another one called Built to Sell, which is, those are often recommended in tandem or like read one or the other. They're the same idea. I've read Built to Sell. Anyway, go ahead.
And so in E-Myth, he talks about there's three business personalities. One is the entrepreneur. So that's the person who is very strategic and focused on the future and the vision of the business. The second is the manager. So they're kind of a blend of that strategy and actually having the tactics to put that in place. And then there's the technician. And I think, you know, he says in the E-Myth, and I do agree with this, a lot of small businesses end up becoming dominated by that technician mindset. Mm-hmm. So if you often think things like, oh, forget it, I'll just do it myself, right? That's right. A good indication that you're the technician. Or if you feel like you can't give things to other people, that's a technician. But I think there may be a larger thing here, which is some people will consciously, maybe not consciously in that they tell themselves the sentence, but they think something like, I just want to be the technician. I don't actually want to do the other two things, right, despite the fact that I'm the owner of this business. Right. And that's where I see the problems really creeping in.
Mm-hmm. I mean, one thing that would be perfectly reasonable advice for that person is to say, have you considered getting a job? Because that's what a lot of jobs are we need you to be this technician. We'll handle all this other stuff for you that you don't want. We'll do sales, you know, we'll do professional financial management of this outfit. We'll do all these things that you have no interest or desire to do so that you can be a specialist in this thing. And that's not where I start with people. And I don't think I have a hard time saying that. That's a bias I have because I'm so much a fan of people having the kind of control and autonomy that successful self-employment offers them. So it's hard for me to say, well, maybe you should just get a job. But that's one perfectly reasonable thing to say to someone who doesn't want to deal with that those other functions of running a business.
Yeah, and a question for you is, you know, you very much advocate. You say your positioning statement is, "I help independent software developers specialize their business," and you know, there's this urge to say, well, you know, I'm going to go so far in my specialization that I'll just specialize in my technical thing, and forget that, you know, there some people argue over, you know, can you be an entrepreneur and be self-employed? It may be that you're just a freelancer, but however you see that problem, it is hard to have a successful solo business or small business if you're not actually a leader in several different areas. I would even argue that it is not sustainable to have it if you don't continually learn how to be better in those three large buckets of your business. How do I get leads? How do I sell and bring revenue in the door? And how do I deliver a consistently good and even better experience and deliverable over time?
Yeah, it's really a chicken and egg thing. I know some people, they kind of imagine this future state for their business where they have a team and where success has led them is having a team. In fact, that's one of the questions I ask people who sign up for my email list, or that's the only question I ask them. Hit reply and tell me what success looks like for your business. There's a subset of those replies I get. Not everybody replies to that email, but whatever. You know, there's a subset of those replies I do get that says, you know, I want to have a team. And they all say, almost all say, I want to have a pipeline. But some will say, I want to have a team. So, and sure, that's a valid idea of what success might look like. And part of the appeal of having a team is that you can delegate some stuff and you can say, you know, I don't have to do this marketing stuff that I kind of always hated, or I don't have to do this lead gen stuff I kind of always hated, or I don't have to talk to prospects and, you know, be in this emotional discomfort zone of talking to strangers or whatever. And I think that's valid, but to get there, that's where it becomes a sort of chicken and the egg problem. That's the egg you want, but you have to build the chicken that lays that egg. And how do you build the chicken? So that'd be a good funny title for this episode.
Building how to build the chicken.
Yeah. Yes. But you know, how do you build the chicken without doing the jobs you want to not do, or you eventually want to delegate? And I'm just not sure that you can. I'm not sure you can. Like, I think a lot of us got this idea. My friend Dave Heffner was in town over the weekend. He's still in town for this conference down in San Francisco, but we spent about 2 days together. And where was I going with that? Oh, crap. It's too early in the day.
Building the chicken?
I haven't had enough caffeine.
Was this related to building the chicken?
Question. It must have been. Otherwise, why would I have brought it up? Crap. I don't want you to have to edit this out, but I'll wear the shame of not knowing where I was going with that.
Let me pick up something that I think could be an interesting point of discussion here. I don't want to let this devolve into a semantic argument, because that's not the point of this. But I do wonder if maybe the definition or the idea that's underpinning delegation in the first place might be the problem, right? So I think one question that I would ask is, how much can you delegate? So, you know, if I talk to someone and they say, you know, I'd like to get to a place where I don't do sales at all, mm-hmm. My advice almost every time, actually every time, if you're selling expertise, it is every time. My advice to you is, you first have to figure out what is the best process or starting place for someone to do this. And so I really don't believe that you can delegate the whole entire conception, because a sale isn't just a moment in time, just like your positioning or your marketing isn't a moment in time. It's a complex set of things that need to happen, and they work in tandem, and they may change a little bit with the market. And ultimately, who's going to be that person to keep up with the times and evolve the business as other things evolve too? And as the business owner, I would challenge you to think, that's got to be you. So sure, eventually, as you figure out a process, you may be able to delegate your sales or your marketing or pieces of it. But a question is, what are they going to do on the first day when you do? You'd better have a plan for them.
Right. I have seen a model where, and this is more in businesses where it might actually make sense to delegate some of those roles. And I've seen a model where the business owner will look for a salesperson that has a lot of contacts in the market they're trying to get more business in.
Yeah,
and
sure.
The thinking there is, well, really what we're doing is we're paying for access to their Rolodex, the salesperson's access to the Rolodex.
Right.
And in a way, they're less delegating the sales process and they're more just buying access to, you know, like the relationships the salesperson has. There's a risk.
Yeah, right.
That goes
my friends
along
with money.
Basically, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's a risk that goes along with that, which is that salesperson's not going to be with you for forever. And so it's sort of like setting up a dependence where if you say, we're going to pay for access to a network, then you're basically ceding control and you're not owning those relationships any longer than the salesperson wants to stick with you.
Yeah, that's right. That's one model I see. And when I look at other professional service firms also, if you look across basically every industry in professional service firms, there are two dominant types of marketers or business developers. One is kind of a hands work person. They're told what to do. Maybe they participate in the strategy a little bit. But basically their job is to develop leads and source opportunities to the point that an expert needs to come in and take over the conversation long before a sale ever happens. Then the second model, and this is probably the most common, is someone matures from technician to owner of small business to kind of partner and full-time salesperson. And if you don't want that model, then you're going to have the first one that I mentioned, which means you need to provide a substantial amount of direction for the person because they don't have the expertise to ever come close to matching your ingrained and developed knowledge about your customer, what you provide, how you can provide it, what the strategic opportunities are. I think there's a little bit of a difficulty there.
I'm sure there's some edge case where, because we're kind of focusing on this life cycle or this movement from new business owner to somebody who owns a more mature business. And that may be maybe a solo person who's amassed valuable expertise and therefore their rates are really high. Or it may be someone who's built a team, right? Those are both valid scaling models or valid models for what your business might look like after some water's under the bridge and you've matured. So there's always that question of how are you going to get from here to there? And I guess there's edge cases where someone, like day one of self-employment for them is day one of them having like a $20 million government contract. Like I imagine if that was you, you could maybe skip some of this, what I call the awkward adolescent years. But that to me truly seems like an edge case.
This is like the two people from Montana who won the Puerto Rico electric contract.
I know that wasn't day one of their business, but that was maybe in their mind, that was day one of big time for their business.
Well, yeah, I would say so.
And I know they don't get the whole, you know, some of the contract on day one. It's dripped out over time, yada, yada. But yeah, like maybe that happens and maybe you are posed with a situation where you have the resources to build a much more mature version of your business on day one. But I think most of us, it's a gradual process. And so we start out solo, or maybe we start out with a business partner. You and I were joking before the show about those situations where people start out with like three business partners.
Yeah.
And that almost looks like you have a team, but then you have these other problems of like everybody feels like they have a vote. And
yeah.
Anyway,
I don't feel that way.
That's a bit of a red. Yeah, it is that way. I mean, it may be structured that way,
right.
or maybe unstructured, and then you've deferred that difficult part of where you actually figure it out. But that feels like a rabbit hole. What I'm saying is that most of us go from this transition from a solo, self-employed person,
sure,
to some future state. And I think I'm 100% with you. I just can't see how you could start out. And you might have a vision of later delegating that stuff, and you can sort of defer that decision about how you're going to delegate it to later. But that means that until you get there, until you can legitimately delegate that stuff, you've got to figure out how to run your business on your own. And here's where I was trying to go with talking about my friend Dave Hefner. We were talking about reading The 4-Hour Workweek.
Oh, yeah.
Tim Ferriss's book.
Yes.
And, you know, that book is so interesting because it's almost become, I think, a kind of cultural touchstone among
yes.
folks like us in our, you know, larger cohort of people running self, you know, doing self-employment the way we're doing it. And that book has influenced our thinking, I think, in positive and negative ways. You know, it really was kind of an amazing book at the time. But I feel like it created this idea that you could start a business with a bunch of delegation happening on day one. And that's tricky. That's not something I feel like everybody can pull off. And so I think it's created this idea, and I think that I wonder what role that plays in these questions we get, where people are like, you know, I want to run a business, I want to be successfully self-employed, but I don't want to do these things. Can I skip out on them from day one? Do you see that? And do you see that maybe possible link with the 4-Hour Workweek?
Yeah, and you know, just to be clear, I don't think Tim Ferriss ever actually said that. That wasn't part of the book, and I feel like the book has become it's more of a symbol than a source of information in a lot of ways. So yeah, I do agree with that. I think that may be underlying it. I do think that, you know, it's, I think the challenge that a lot of people face is as an entrepreneur, often you leave your job. And so I actually did a survey mm-hmm. and asked people, why do you want to start your own business? And this was from a former client of mine who I won't share. But, you know, basically they had a huge audience of people who were in a position where they were looking to start a business. And we asked them, what's driving this? And I was surprised by how many people said, I want to fire my boss, basically. I hate working for someone else. And then the second one was freedom. I want to do whatever I want. I want freedom over my time and kind of how I behave in my professional life, which I want that too. What you realize as you do this, if you want to outsource or delegate some critical part of your business, is it's still work. Right? That's an inescapable part of it, is there are parts of your business that you don't enjoy as much as other parts, or maybe you don't enjoy them at all. But in the early days, and as you're in these awkward adolescent years where you're wearing your dad's coat and the sleeves are too long and the shoes don't fit and all of that, right? Like my first high school dance, you know, in those times, you kind of, I think there may be an element of like, oh my gosh, why am I doing this again? This is not what I signed up for. I hate sales. I hate marketing. I hate process and operations. And I think that may be something that underlies it, but it is part of the package.
You know, it's interesting. I have more and more started to realize that I was pretty good at playing the W-2 game, you know, the full-time employee game. And the amount of actual work, when I reflect on the full-time employee jobs I had, the amount of actual work I did during a day, if I could somehow put that through like a filter and extract all the stuff that wasn't work from what was work.
Right.
It was a shockingly small amount of actual work that got done because, you know, I'd take the job, I'd spend the first few months, maybe the first 6 months kind of figuring out, and then just sort of do the minimum and still meet expectations or even exceed expectations. But I had all this freedom to like surf the internet and goof off during the day on the job. It's actually more freedom than I have now.
Yes, I agree with you. That is actually the advice I give to most people.
Yeah.
Is if you're after this for freedom, I think you're going to quickly learn that you're probably going to have to work more, and certainly you're going to have to use much more brain power, concentration, and there will be significantly more sacrifice in order to make this work.
Now, I do have more of something that also fits under the umbrella of freedom, and I feel like we need a different word for it. I don't know what the word is. Maybe it's autonomy. Maybe it's agency. Maybe it's there's a slight nuance to it. But the kind of like freedom to do whatever the fuck I want, whenever the fuck I want, I had more of that when I did not work for myself.
Yes, I totally agree with you. I mean, you know, perfect example is we met yesterday in our mastermind group, and I brought a problem to the group, and it became clear through the wonderful feedback of the group what I needed to do. And I said, okay, that's what I'm going to do tomorrow. Right. Yeah. There's no one to say, no, that's not a priority right now. Yeah. I get to
decide. Let me get my boss to approve that.
Right. So, I mean, that is one thing that I like also. And when you were talking about feeding all of your time in and having a filter for all the stuff that wasn't work, right. I was thinking more of like a bullshit detector than a filter. Yeah. Right. Because, you know, same here. Like I think I exceeded expectations. I achieved some great things, but, it's a lot easier knowing that you're going to receive a paycheck in 2 weeks, no matter what you do today, more or less, as long as you do the minimum, to just kind of goof off or do something else.
Yeah.
But I do want to come back to this idea of, you know, I think my core question, Philip, is how much expertise is enough? You tell a lot of people, well, you tell everybody, and so do I, to specialize their business, and the benefits that come from that are tremendous. But one question I have is, do you need to be an expert in sales and marketing and in your technical work? Like, how much do you really need, and what is a reasonable expectation for someone listening to this if they're thinking they eventually want to delegate something?
So we're talking about expertise in these business functions that are, they play a necessary supporting role. We're not talking about expertise in like the thing you sell, right?
Yeah. You know, I'm not going to speak for anybody, but it seems like there may be an urge to say, I'm just going to be the best, whatever, designer, coder, you know, consultant, whatever it is, I'm going to be the best at that. And then I'll just learn the bare minimum on those other things and hope, and that should be enough to keep my business flying forward.
Well, of course, it depends. What a lot of self-employed software developers do is they chase bubbles and they flee gluts. So chasing a bubble looks like this. It looks like being developer, like a PHP developer in the year 2008, 2009, and going, wow, this thing Apple released really does seem like the future. And, you know, right. now you can build native apps for it. Whenever that happened, what was that, around 2010? And then going, oh man, I'm all in on that. And so you get in on that, and it becomes a bubble. And so what's required of your biz dev skills and your sales skills, your marketing skills is next to nothing. You know, you go tweak your LinkedIn profile and do pretty good work for a couple clients, and you're enjoying the benefits of a bubble for another 5, 7, maybe even 10 years. And then, you know, you get to the end of that and you're like, gosh, the rates aren't what they used to be, and the projects seem to be not as good as they used to be. And so you can chase another bubble. And you just sort of look around for something that has the same kind of dynamics of that. And you're like, oh, maybe blockchain is looking a lot like the, you know, app building ecosystem looked 10 years ago. So I'm going to double down on that.
Yeah.
And so if you do that, and that is, I don't love that as a business development or as a career development strategy, but it can work for a while. People usually get tired of it, and then they come to me. I talk to a lot of people who are like, I just can't do it again, man. I can't re-up on a whole nother tech ecosystem just to remain relevant.
Yeah.
So even that has a shelf life, but I will say that delays the inevitable of figuring out biz dev.
Let me ask you this. What do you think is the breaking point for people to say, it's too much, I'm not going to do it again, I need to build something that actually lasts?
Well, I know when the breaking point is. It's about two or three rounds on the merry-go-round of a bubble glut for tech skills. That's for most people about where it is. What causes it is, I think it's almost like a time trigger. It's like they just start getting old. I think what causes it is you lose the fascination with the tools and developers. And I've been this way too. Again, I know this could come across like a pretty harsh criticism, but you know, I have a technical background too. And so I understand this fascination with the tools. The tools are so freaking cool. So yeah. Just after a while that starts to wear off, it's like, is there more or God, not another learning curve. The old tools were fine. Why are we having to replace them with new tools just to get paid to do what we love? So it's, I think what is really when. It's just like you get tired of it. It's just like I want to ride a different ride. I don't want to be in this merry-go-round anymore.
Yeah, and I did want to give a counterpoint to what I was talking about early, which is the normal model for an expertise-driven business. And so if we think about, okay, when would it be really easy to outsource sales in a service business? And typically where I've seen that work really well and be able to scale fast is in a productized service business. So I think about our mutual friend Jake, right? Yeah. And he has Lead Cookie, right? And you pay a fixed amount that the salesperson offers to everybody. They don't have to scope out a project. Yeah. And it's very clear to understand what you get. Someone will go prospect for you on LinkedIn and you reply when someone engages. Yep. That's it, right? Done for you lead generation on LinkedIn. Or I think about my buddy Alex has a business called WP Curve. Uh-huh. And you can pay $200 a month and you get unlimited WordPress fixes, or at least right. It was that.
Right.
And so the person behind the so the question really is, what are your customers buying? What are your clients buying? So if you have a very customized, expertise-driven business, they're buying the way you think. That's a big part of it. Right. They're buying your ability to come up with a completely unique and customized solution. And so to me, that part can't just be given to someone else. I don't see a way around that.
Well, at some point, that expertise, it starts out in a single person's head. At
exactly.
A certain point, in some businesses, if they're going to scale, I refer to it as horizontal scaling, when you add headcount. And some businesses, that's absolutely the right decision for that business, is to scale horizontally. And so you would actually have to move it out of your head into something that's a process or something that is a way of doing things. And when I say a process, I don't mean a process everybody sort of knows about, like agile or waterfall development or whatever. I mean a legitimately proprietary process. And then you would actually have to train people to even understand it.
Yes.
And that can be done. That's doable. There's, you know, thousands of professional services firms that do something like that. And there's no reason you couldn't train a salesperson on the process too. But that's a whole different ballgame than I bet what people are thinking about when they think about delegating stuff like sales or marketing really early on in their business. And I have to say, part of my perspective on this is informed by, for, you know, about a year, I ran a productized service called My Content Sherpa. And the whole idea was to allow people to delegate part of their content, their marketing, specifically the content marketing part. And so it's not, I'm not coming at this from some sort of pure theory basis here. I actually have experience deeply embedded in the question we're talking about here, which is, can you delegate this stuff? And I'm telling you, it's not easy to do at any stage in your business, but especially early on, it's not easy to do.
Totally. Yeah. And you know, where I see a lot of, you know, marketing, there's so many marketing agencies, so this is an easy one to look at. typically they won't completely take over all marketing strategy, vision, direction. Typically they're brought in to do an expert skill that the company doesn't have, or they're there to scale. So let's say you have, you know, some great funnel that's working for you that's based on Facebook or LinkedIn traffic. You probably are not an expert in buying 10 times more traffic than you have now. Right. So someone else can come in and do that and help you optimize and scale. But what they're not going to be able to do is figure out what your offer should be in the first place. That exactly. part is just so, I mean, that's one of the hardest things in all of business is to figure that out. Right. And as an entrepreneur, that is your job, or as the business owner, that is your job.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good point. Is there are scenarios where by delegating, what you're really doing is bringing in outside expertise to shorten your learning curve. Or, and you may not ever bring that function in house, but like I think of Facebook ads or managing paid advertising is probably a great example where. Yeah, it might be core to your business, but it's not as core to your business as the expertise that you're delivering. And maybe you're kind of trying to augment some existing marketing efforts that you're handling in-house. I think it makes perfect sense to bring in some kind of, you know, specialist expert to help you, you know, launch some advertising, maybe do a little bit of knowledge transfer so you could eventually manage it in-house, or maybe you never manage it in-house, but still. You're not so much delegating as augmenting with outside expertise. And maybe that's a better model actually for folks to think about early on in their business. I just can't get very far away from the idea that you are going to have to be a jack of all trades in running your business.
Yes.
And you should develop specialized expertise that's the value of what you do for clients. It's underpinned by that specialized expertise, but you just accept the idea that you're going to have to be competent at sales and competent at lead generation and marketing.
I agree. So that is the threshold that I would set too, is competence. And
yeah.
Let's be honest, that's competence among a class of business owners. That's not find someone on the street and can you explain marketing to them? You actually have to be able to make it work in a competitive environment. And the advice you gave is exactly the kind of nuance that I really wanted to introduce into this conversation. Mm-hmm. And that is, if I'm talking about marketing or sales or even your delivery or making your processes more transferable and easy for other people to understand, it's not a binary, should I delegate this or shouldn't I? If I think about sales, right, there's prospecting. There could be some outbound lead generation in there. There's your initial phone call. There's following up. There's doing your pitch. There's the negotiating and the contracts. There's like lots of different pieces. So rather than going in and thinking, how can I just take all of it off my plate? I think a better question is, which parts of this can I formalize and give away?
Right. Yeah. Yep. And I mean, how long would you say it took you to gain basic competence in the stuff that you felt like you were not so good at? Maybe you had a sort of natural advantage with sales because you're not afraid of talking to people or whatever, right? But
yeah,
certainly there was some area where you're not as good. And how long did it take to develop competence there?
Oh boy, it's so hard. Basic competence for me is an arguable idea right now. No, I would say, all joking aside, when I think about digital marketing, you know, I think the reason I'm having such a hard time answering this is I'm not trying to be a weasel and get out of it. It's just that the more you learn, the more you realize I didn't know shit a year ago, right? So it's hard to say, like, at what point did I achieve basic competence? But I would say for marketing, you know, probably like 3 to 6 months of mm-hmm. really rigorous study on a very focused small slice mm-hmm. of digital marketing.
Yeah.
And then, of course, over time, you read more, you have experience, you work with more people, you see the results of your work, and you're like, oh, shit, that didn't work. Or that really did. What happened there? I didn't think it would work that well, but it did.
Right.
So, you know, I think it's a combination of everything. I am a very natural learner. Like, in the gym this morning, I was listening to a podcast about politics while I was lifting weights. And I know that's not how everybody, not everybody has the drive to learn new things that I do, which I'm not saying like I'm better or anything like that. Just that, that's what my mind needs constantly. So, you know, I would say generally like probably 12 to 24 months, 1 to 2 years to just achieve a basic level, especially if you're, you've never sold before, if you've never marketed, if you've never thought about process, if you've never thought about management, like whatever the function is that you want to give to someone else, I'd say 1 to 2 years is about the time where you'd start to go, okay, I'm feeling less like a newbie at this point.
Yeah, I was, as you were talking, I was thinking about just one specific example for me selling the Positioning Accelerator program and figuring out, and I did this in a very casual way, like the figuring out of how to sell that, I would describe as pretty casual and pretty much like, well, I'm going to, this is a thing I want to sell. I believe in the value. So I'm selling it and then I'm making adjustments to how I sell it as I go. And I would say it took about a year or two to sort of figure that out. Again, it wasn't something I tackled head on where I'm like, okay, we are going to figure some shit out here. It was just more like constant experimentation, iteration. And now I actually could describe how I sell that. And I could describe the whole process. And I feel like there's an intentional approach to it, but it took about a year or two to get there. So that's my answer, which, you know, I'm not surprised it pretty closely matches yours.
Yeah. And, you know, let's take another extreme example. One of the largest service companies, you know, there's lots of management consulting companies, but I happen to read a Harvard Business Review case study on Sapient.
Okay.
So they're a big company. They do lots of stuff, management consulting. They have a marketing division. They have, you know, all kinds of things, succession planning, like you name it, they could probably do it for you.
Sure.
And what was interesting about the way they scaled their business is they were able to land gigantic contracts within a year of opening up. And so they were in a position where they, first of all, were very diligent about setting the vision of the company. Here's what we're about. Here's the way we do our work. Here are our quality standards. Mm-hmm. And then they started hiring people who are very sophisticated and were well-trained already. Mm-hmm. And what that did is it bought them time. They had money in the bank and they had time to go focus on being better, you know, back to the e-myth, mm-hmm. being better managers and entrepreneurs, and they let other people do the technical work entirely. But what they never outsourced ever was the kind of vision and how the company would be structured and run. Yeah. And, you know, I just don't see a way to do that.
Well, you know, people who have a lot more data and more experience than I do would agree. You know, I think of David C. Baker, who's done a lot of very sort of scientific looking into this idea of like what roles can and can't you delegate and what kind of personality types are best for those roles. Right. And I'm a little fuzzy on the details, but there's a podcast that he did with Blair Enns where he sort of walks through all this stuff. And the one role you cannot, absolutely, the, you know, the owner or the chief principal of a firm cannot delegate is the vision and the positioning.
Right. Well, didn't you also say that certain personality types tended to be more successful based on his research?
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I think he references this in his book, The Business of Expertise, but, you know, he's done a DISC profile assessments of, I think, over 1,000 firms, which is not, I mean, that's just a number of businesses. So, I don't know, maybe 10,000 people.
Yeah.
But when he's looking at the, you know, the owner or the principals of the firm, he finds this just astonishingly high correlation between a high level of what the DISC assessment calls drive, and people being successful firm owners. So there is a sort of astonishingly strong correlation between those two things, apparently, based on his research.
Well, it's not just him. It's if you look at like Fortune 500 CEOs too, they're disproportionately D-driven personalities.
Yeah. And I would hate for the folks at home to take that and think of it as like, well, if that's not me, then I guess I should get a job, because yeah, I don't think that's
the takeaway.
Yeah.
Yeah. For me, the takeaway is certain people will have an advantage in this area, yeah. Right? That doesn't mean it precludes you, dear listener, yeah. from improving yourself. And so the question I would ask is, well, why do they have an advantage? And what are some things that you can do to help yourself start to establish more of an advantage? Mm-hmm. That would be my takeaway here.
Yeah. Well, same. And I was thinking, well, what would that be? Having more sales conversations is a good thing, but that comes from having more leads coming in the door, which maybe that's a bit of a chicken and an egg thing too.
Well, I think empathy is huge. I think boldness is huge. I think decisiveness is huge. Mm-hmm. Those are some of the traits that would be highly correlated with a D personality. Aggression, obviously, mm-hmm. would be another one. But, you know, I think one big misconception is this idea that you need to be an extrovert to be a successful owner of a business, and it's not true. Mm-hmm. On the flip side of that, there's, unless you are the world's best lead generator, it's very difficult for you to grow your influence and public perception of expertise unless you interact with a lot of people and you have what I like to call work friends, mm-hmm. like me and you, Philip, right? Yeah. Like, there are things that we can do for each other. I'm constantly telling people I talk to, I did this yesterday. Yeah. Someone came to me and said, I think I need your coaching. And I said, I don't think you do. I think you need to talk to Philip.
Yeah.
And, you know, I wouldn't be in a position to refer you any work if we didn't know each other. Right. And if we didn't nurture this relationship. And, you know, I think that's another thing is like D personalities aren't the most relational necessarily. they're very known as being hyper rational and sort of, you know, just shitting on people whenever the moment moves them. Like, I share a personality with Steve Jobs, if that illustrates anything. And I've worked very hard to not be that guy.
You got a lot of rough edges to sand off, huh?
Yeah, I know, indeed. So we all have work to do, right?
Yeah. But
you know, it's the aggression, I think, that it partially provides that drive to continue to just do whatever you have to do to make it work.
Yeah, I mean, one facet of what you're saying is, we could reduce this down to a very simplistic saying by...
my favorite thing to do. Let's remove all nuance.
Right, yeah. Working for yourself is not easier than having a job. It may be less painful in different ways. Like, you don't have to deal with a shitty boss, although you can easily replace one shitty boss with 10, you know, variable quality bosses.
Yes.
When you're doing client services. So it's just over and over, I think it's not, more and more, I'm like, the bottom line of working for yourself is it's not easier. It may be more rewarding. And I think there is an element of working harder now to create something you can amortize or, you know, get an ROI from later. I think that can be part of working for yourself, but it's just not easier than working a job.
All right. This is the last thing I'll say, because I do love this topic, because people, yeah. sometimes I get asked, what's it like to work for yourself? And I would say, it's painful. That would be my first response. Right. It's painful. It's not easy.
Yeah.
But it, for me at least, it has been the absolute most important growth opportunity of my entire life. I've learned so much more about myself. I've learned so much more about what I'm capable of, what I absolutely suck at.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's just a tremendous learning experience. And part of it, sometimes, back to the topic of this podcast, is having to do things we don't enjoy or don't, we're not totally driven to do.
Yeah. Yeah, you said it's, what did you say, it's painful?
I did. But it's very Buddhist of me, right? All life is suffering.
Yeah, pick your preferred style of suffering. And I just would hasten to add that it is. I mean, it can be productive pain, though. I guess is what, yes, I would hasten to add. It's like going to the gym is painful, or can be, or exercising, or anything that requires discipline can be painful. But is it worth it, or what are you getting as a result of that? And there's just no guarantees that what you're getting is going to be worth the pain.
Right.
That's the scary part of self-employment. At least with a job, while you have the job, you know you're getting a paycheck. With self-employment or any entrepreneurial endeavor, there really is no guarantee that that pain is going to turn into something that the thing you wanted it to turn into.
Yep.
That'd be a great, agree. Great, gloomy note to end the podcast on.
Well, have a great day, everybody. Yeah. Well, maybe that's another topic for another time, is the relative safety of a job versus self-employment, because I have some strong opinions about how things are changing. And maybe if you can figure out how to be self-employed, I do think it's a much more stable thing, because you have so much control over what happens.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's something we probably should defer. Like in 2008, when I got laid off, I thought having a job was 100% safe. You know, I just had never had the experience of not having a job when I wanted it. So I just perceived it as a very safe thing. That'd be a fun thing to talk about some more.
Well, let's do that next time.
All right.
All right, Philip. Good to talk to you.
You too, man. Have a good weekend. Bye.